You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll take a look at the future of health care in the United States with the Affordable Care Act in limbo and congressional Republicans going back to the drawing board.
First, Lawrence Krauss says the story of how the universe came to be, as told by an accumulating body of science, is more riveting than any other story in the world.
In his new book, Krauss tells us why, shares some of the big discoveries in science history, and previews what's next.
He's the director of the Origins Project at Arizona State University and co-director of Cosmology Initiative. He's the author of the new book, The Greatest Story Ever Told, so far. Lawrence Krauss joins us now. Welcome to Central Time.
It's good to be with you virtually.
Well, you write that the universe was not created for humans, but that life is kind of here because of messy coincidence. And this is something you write that can be unsettling, a cold, hard fact for human beings. Why do you think it can be unnerving for people to think about the universe in those terms?
Well, thinking of our existence as an accident is for some people disturbing. They'd like to think there's some cosmic purpose why we're here. And it's, in some sense, it seems it consoles them that the universe is so big and strange to think that there's a reason we're here. But in fact, I would argue, first of all, I would argue it's kind of solipsistic to assume the whole universe was created for us. In fact, instead of the fact that we're just a cosmic bystander in an amazing universe, and we're fortunate enough to have evolved intelligence to be able to learn about the universe back to the earliest moments of the Big Bang and learn about its fundamental structures. In some sense, in my mind, recognizing that we're a cosmic afterthought doesn't make us our own purpose any less significant. We are here. We have brains. We are on a remarkable planet where that life has evolved for over 4 billion years to get to us, and we should enjoy our brief moment in the sun. We should use our brains and use the results of science to make the future better. And in some sense, the fact that we're in control of our own destiny, if you wish, and that no one else is watching out for us, makes it even more important that we act sensibly.
And in your new book, you deliberately use language and ideas from the Bible, things like, in the beginning there was light. You say there had to be. What are you getting at by lining up the scriptural story of creation against the narrative of the universe as told by science?
Well, I guess what I was doing was pointing out how the real story is so much more fascinating. That's why I call it the greatest story ever told so far. Partly it's a takeoff on the Bible story called The Greatest Story Ever Told. But the best part of this story is the so far part. It gets better. There are new surprises. The universe continues to surprise us. And I guess what I wanted to do was point out that, well, this story that was written 2,000 years ago by Iron Age sort of peasants who didn't know the Earth or the Sun was their effort to understand how the universe worked. But we have, over the centuries, made incredible progress and the greatest intellectual journeys people have ever taken to understand the way the universe really works, and is so much more fascinating and surprising, mostly because scientists, you know, are people, and which many people don't realize, and so they have biases and prejudices, and in this story, there are lots of dead ends and red herrings because people follow what they think is the way the world should work, but the great thing about science is it overcomes those biases and sort of drags physicists kicking and screaming in the right direction. And I think that story, a human story, is really, really remarkable. And so by comparison, I couldn't help many people think of the Bible as for many people, the last word on how the universe works. And I wanted, in some sense, to make that comparison. So sure, the sections of the book happen to have Genesis, Exodus, and Revelations, and they're Bible quotes, and they're great Bible quotes, so they're good. So they tend to be relevant to some of the things I'm saying. The Bible is a literary work, and it's got lots of interesting quotes in it. So why not use them?
So the way you see it, can someone be a respectable scientist and a person of faith?
Well, of course, there are respectable scientists who are people of faith. That doesn't, however, make the story any more real. I think, first of all, let me make it clear. Science can't disprove the existence of God or purpose in the universe. All we can say is that there's no evidence of purpose. So if you're of a vague sense of deism, that can always be consistent science. And people like Einstein, who didn't believe in a personal God but sort of believed in order in the universe, the God of Spinoza, as he said, were certainly that way. But there are religious scientists, but you know, I don't think that proves anything, because there are scientists who are Republicans, there are scientists who are Democrats. So I think it's possible for people to hold mutually inconsistent views at the same time. The point is, the science, we have to force our beliefs to conform to the evidence of reality. And as long as the scientists do that, then their personal convictions in other senses are don't really matter. And most, and frankly, most scientists who call themselves people of faith in the sense of one of the world's, you know, major religions, the way many people call themselves, say, Christians, who don't buy all the stuff in the Bible, they just pick and choose what they like. And they, for them, some, to some extent, Christianity means that they're quote-unquote good people. And that's fine. But what worries me is it by the same token leads to the notion that people who simply don't buy the notion of God are somehow bad people. And that's a notion that I'd like to overcome. It's unfortunate.
We're talking with Lawrence Krauss right now. He's director of the Origins Project at Arizona State University, co-director of Cosmology Initiative. And we're talking about his new book. It's called The Greatest Story Ever Told So Far. And Lawrence, going back to this idea of a story that's changing because science moves forward, what do you see as the biggest shifts in the scientific narrative in maybe the last 20 years?
Well, what's really neat about the book, I think, by the way, is that there have been huge revolutions in our picture of the universe, not only over the larger scales, in my last book, Universe from Nothing, was about that, but in our understanding of the universe on the smallest scales. We now realize that the universe we see is kind of an illusion, that there's this invisible field everywhere throughout space that affects the properties of the particles that make us up. And if it wasn't there, if it hadn't frozen in that configuration in the early history of the universe, we and everything we see in the universe would not be here. It's kind of like icicles on a window in a winter. And in Wisconsin, you know what that looks like. And if you see the beautiful pattern of icicles, imagine living on one of those icicles pointing in a certain direction. Well, that civilization would somehow say that direction was very special. It was meant to be there, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But it's just an accident. Our existence, in some sense, is predicated on a similar accident. The field froze. We call it the Higgs field in the early universe. And if it hadn't frozen that way, then the particles that make us up wouldn't have mass. And if they didn't, then you wouldn't have stars, planets, galaxies, people, aliens, etc. And that, what's amazing is that's a remarkable claim, that there's an invisible field everywhere throughout space. It almost sounds religious, doesn't it, that is responsible for our existence. But what turns it into science is we said if it's there, we have to find it. And it was a 50-year effort after recognizing that that solves some real problems in physics and recognizing it, again, you want to shake, when you read this book, you want to shake people and say, you know, you've got the answer, it's right there, but why does it take you 20 years to realize it? It's all there. But once we finally realized that was the answer, then the question was it the right answer? And that required a 50-year journey to build the most complicated machine ever built, the Large Hadron Collider, to test it. And lo and behold, it turns out to be true. And that frankly, by the way, that surprised me. I really didn't think the Higgs was real. I thought it was an interesting, nice explanation, but nature would find a trickier one. And turns out nature didn't.
Yeah, you said you were surprised that it didn't turn up dark matter instead, or proof of dark matter.
Yeah, exactly. It turns out that the Higgs is fairly hard to discover. The Large Hadron Collider wasn't guaranteed to discover it, but the particles, one of the best candidates for the particles that make up the dark matter dominating our galaxy, are particles that in some sense should be visible at the Large Hadron Collider and should have been a lot easier to see. And the fact that they weren't seen first means that, well, it doesn't rule out that idea, because there's a large range of parameter space where they could exist. But it's getting harder and harder and a little bit uglier, and maybe that direction is the wrong one. I certainly thought they'd see the candidates for dark matter before, in fact, instead of the Higgs. And, you know, and it's fine. And what's nice, by the way, people don't realize, if you're a theoretical physicist, the two most enjoyable states to be in some sense, are wrong and confused.
Why?
Because it means there's more to learn. It means our ideas are wrong, and nature is going to surprise us. And that, it's those surprises and mysteries that make life so exciting, and that's what makes the greatest story we told so far. The greatest story is that we didn't invent it. It was revealed to us by nature, and that once again, the so far part, we will continue to be surprised as long as we continue to look out at the universe, as long as we continue to ask questions. And I'm a little worried in the current climate in Washington that there's not an interest in asking questions, whether it's in science, art, music, or literature. The budget cuts are in some sense combating what makes a nation worth defending, just to defend it, and it's of some concern to me. The greatest story will continue as long as we keep asking questions and look out, and there's so much more to be discovered, and that's why the story will be better next year, and some of the kids who might read my book hope will make the story better in a generation, and I find that wonderful.
I want to talk briefly before we wrap up here about science education. You say it's being taught kind of like it's a collection of facts, and it's really more than that. It's a method for discovery. Why do you think that's important as you go forward and talk about the value of science in society?
That's a very good question. I think that it is true. We tend to teach scientists a bunch of facts you memorize, and then other people say, well, I have other facts. But science is a process for uncovering facts, for separating the wheat from the chaff, with skeptical inquiry and empirical reliance on empirical evidence and testing and looking at many sources and testing again. And those tools are not just important for science. They've allowed science to unveil this illusion of reality, which I talk about in the book, but they also allow us to unveil the illusion of reality that occurs in everyday life, in politics. We need the tools of science to have a healthy democracy, to base our public policy on empirical evidence. And we also need it to overcome, in a world where the internet is full of not only facts, but quote-unquote alternative facts, we need to teach students the filter. We don't need to, I mean, there's more facts in my cell phone that I can get from than I can at a school, but there are more misfacts. We no longer need to treat schools as sort of storehouses of information. They have to teach kids the techniques, the filters to separate nonsense from sense, and that's more important than the facts. Later on, they can get facts, but that allows them to distinguish facts from nonsense. And those are the tools in a world where we're inundated by information and misinformation that we need in order to move forward progressively, so we can make policies as a nation that continue to not only make us sustainable, but make the future better than the past.
Lawrence, thanks a lot for joining us.
It's been a pleasure.
Lawrence Krauss is the director of the Origins Project at Arizona State University, co-director of Cosmology Initiative, and the author of the book we were just talking about, The Greatest Story Ever Told So Far.
Coming up, we'll talk about what's next in healthcare policy and reform. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Riggert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.